Hi everyone, welcome to ABC's of Anesthesia. Now today, I've got an episode where I'm going to talk to some of my junior trainees, and I've known these trainees for quite a while, Ruth and Paolo. Like they've just helped ABC's of Anesthesia and the journey of ABC's of Anesthesia in a massive way. Now Ruth, she runs a lot of the operations stuff, organizing a lot of the chutes for medical students and interns. And Paolo did an amazing session with interviews. And so they really come from a place where they've gone through that journey of, you know, going through med school, intern, residency, and they've got a crit care year for this year, which is an incredibly difficult position to get. So 240 or so applicants for four positions at a hospital. It's extremely competitive. And I've got to say, you know, these guys, they performed extremely well. Like, you know, the amount of work that you guys would have done to build up your CVs and your interview skills and just, you know, do well in your anesthetic rotations. Like, I can imagine the amount of work that you put in. So welcome, Paolo. Welcome, Ruth.
Thanks so much, Lahiru. Thanks for having us today.
Thank you so much, Lahiru. Yeah, what a great opportunity to be able to tell everyone a bit about our story. I'm Paolo. I'm one of the PGY3 Crit Care HMOs in 2024, and one of my co-residents, Ruth, is here to join us as well. I think it's really valuable to share the training journey or the incoming training journey for us because there's a lot of hidden rules, things that should be done that no one really talks about. So we'd love to share our story with you guys today and hopefully you find it helpful.
Excellent. So I'll first ask Ruth. Ruth, how did you know that anesthesia was for you?
Yeah, so I did an anesthetics rotation in my final year of med school. It was very brief, just a week, but I really enjoyed it. You know, being in theatre, the people you get to work with, the medicine itself. And one of my main role models in medical school was an anaesthetist as well. So that certainly shifted me into one direction. But then, you know, while working as a doctor as well, I still wanted to, you know, get a broad range of experience and work in different areas. And I haven't actually done an anaesthetics rotation before, but I have worked in lots of surgical specialties, obstetrics, ED, ICU. So, you know, working in all those different areas, you still get a bit of contact with anaesthetics. And so I always kind of had it in the back of my mind that, you know, I think this is for me. And I gradually excluded all those other specialties. And yeah, and then, you know, last year I was like, I'm pretty sure this is what I want to do, but I think I still need to have a day in theatre just to know what a day as an anaesthetist is like. So, you know, I arranged that with one of the consultants at my hospital, spent a day in theatre and I was like, yep, this is for me. Yeah. And then, yeah, applied for the position.
Yeah. And actually, Ruth, so what do you think? I think a lot of people end up coming into anesthetics and they do find it a really different pace. Like I remember the first time I went into anesthetics, I kept getting offered tea breaks. And if everyone knows the medical system, when you're an intern in any rotation, you don't get offered tea breaks. That's not a thing. And I was like, is this, do they even want me here? Like, is this, they're trying to get rid of me? do you have that sense of like, there's just, you know, what's going on here?
Oh, it is very different because, you know, I don't think there's any other specialty where you're one-on-one with a boss for the entire day. And, you know, that can be, it's very different and, you know, you're making a lot of conversation, both medical and not. So, you know, and the tea breaks itself gives you both a bit of a break from that as well. And yeah, definitely the tea breaks, you know, being an intern or, you know, junior doctor and not getting a lunch break, you know, you see this whole new world. You're like, oh, what is this specialty? I need to know more about this as well. So yeah, the tea break is very welcome.
I can just imagine if I go ask someone in the next interview, what do you like about anesthetics? Look, I really like the tea breaks. That really speaks to me. Anyway, Paolo, how about yourself? How did you think that? Why did you think anesthesia was for you?
Yes, I had a bit of a journey as well to finding anesthesia as a specialty. As a medical student, I was very interested in surgery specifically. I spent the majority of my medical school time really going to theater, enjoying what it's like to be a surgical intern resident, and even thought about really pursuing urology. But I guess where I really understood what it's like to be a doctor is when I actually set foot in the hospital with my own name badge, my own stethoscope, and ready to see my own patients. And what I noticed in a field like surgery is that there are some things that I wanted to explore further, more medical side of patient management. And then there was this bridge in between that I noticed called perioperative medicine, where you focus on bringing the patients to the most optimal state in order to go through a level of anesthesia and surgery, which can be quite You know, it's a lot on the body to take on, and then seeing how they recover after theater. And I thought that was really fascinating. For me, what that took is you need to understand the surgery that this patient's about to have, as well as understand all the medical comorbidities and how to manage them well before the theater and even during the operation, so that they can get through safely. For me, that was, you know, the exact kind of medicine that I wanted to practice. And then when I was fortunate enough to get an anesthesia rotation in my second year, I remember, Lahira, you were pulling out all these medications in the tray, and I said, I've never seen some of these medications before. And then watching the patient's hemodynamics change with each medication was fascinating and, to be honest, quite exciting. So I thought, wow, like, what a field of critical care medicine. And I feel that I was really able to find this field through exploration of a different field, exploring other specialties like Ruth, like 6 months in emergency where I was seeing critically ill patients, and then having the gamut of medical knowledge at your fingertips with vasopressors and ventilators. I thought, wow, anesthesia, what a specialty. This is exactly where I want to be.
I think it really speaks to the short attention span that I might have. Like when I remember seeing physicians, and they'd see a patient after a month and go, oh yeah, things have gone really well. It must have been that extra 5 milligrams of furosemide I gave. And I thought, hold on, you're not gonna take credit for that patient's better heart failure from that extra 5 milligrams of furosemide, are you? Like, surely there's a few other things in that month that worked. Whereas, you know, when we do something, we know that we did it wrong, or we absolutely know that we did it right. It really speaks to that immediate, immediate effect of everything that we do. Hey, so Paolo, I mean, a lot of other fields will give you this thing of, you know, like you help patients, perioperative journey, the gamut of your skills, you know, but why anesthetics?
I think anesthetics is really, for me, what bridged all of my interests. Mm. Anesthesia gives you a lot of medical knowledge required to manage patients who could be really well, young patients having elective procedures, to really unwell emergency patients who are coming from the community with, you know, life-threatening conditions. And having all of that medical knowledge, helping you look after this patient, the most critical part of their journey, of their life, is something that I found really fulfilling. But then also for me, being the leader of a specific healthcare team, as in someone who's in charge of running a med call, a code blue, is something that I've really, really resonated with while being in the hospital. A lot of my experience is running leadership across all parts of my journey as a student, particularly in medical school. And then being able to practice that in the hospital with skills that I've been able to refine, for me, feels like this is, you know, something that's really maximizing my skill set and a place that I really want to improve my skills. So, I think while you're right, Lahiru, that a lot of specialties do give you that sense of fulfillment, I have to say anesthesia really gives you an experience like nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely. And why don't we go on to, so you can maybe, Ruth, you can tell the audience, where are you on your journey, especially training? And do you have tips on getting experience in anesthesia? I know, you know, anesthesia time is very hard to come by. Yeah, what do you do to get that valuable few weeks?
Yeah, this is definitely something that I, you know, struggled to get that time the last few years. So I guess a bit about me, I'm, you know, PGY4 going to the 2024 clinical year now. And so I, you know, put in my preferences for an anesthetics rotation, PGY2 is my hospital offered that, unfortunately missed out, but, you know, still got an intensive care rotation and emergency as well as surgical rotations. And then going from there, I applied for the critical care job for PGY3, as you know, most people do, and unfortunately missed out again. But I decided to do another general year, and I'm really glad I did do that, looking back now, because I got to do obstetrics, pediatrics as well, which, you know, areas I hadn't even come across since medical school, and both also incredibly relevant to anesthetics. And I also did an oncology rotation, which was not really in my preferences at all. But I don't know, you know, people listening have worked with oncology patients, but they can be really, really sick. And so, you know, recognizing deteriorating patients on the ward and, you know, being involved in the management of that, I found, you know, really useful. And, you know, going back to, you know, what ANSCA kind of lays out that they want from their applicants is, you know, people who've worked in, you know, not just critical care specialties, but, you know, have a broad range of knowledge in various areas of medicine. So I guess, yeah, going back to your question, I think, you know, having that extra year, I'm really grateful for. At the time I was, you know, disappointed, but it gave me the time to, you know, reflect on what I had done already, you know, how I could improve, but still, you know, have some really relevant experience in medicine to anaesthetics as well.
Yeah, nice. And Pally, yeah, where are you at in your journey of specialty training? And yeah, how did you get your experience? It sounds like you were one of the lucky ones. You got that valuable few weeks in anaesthesia.
Yeah, I was definitely fortunate. So I'm going into my PGY3 year now. I did my internship at the same health service that I did my PGY2 and PGY3 year. In PGY1, as an intern, I did essentially all the rotations required of me to get my general registration. My core rotation for surgery was urology, but I also was able to do some specialty medical rotations like infectious diseases. And then going into my PGY2 year, I did nearly 6 months of emergency with a tiny bit of anesthesia sprinkled in there. I got about 7 weeks and then ended up doing specialty and general surgery as the night cover resident, as well as finishing off my clinical year doing colorectal and general surgery. So, and then now I'm fortunate enough to do critical care. So I guess in my journey, I was able to do a fair amount of specialty and general medicine, as well as specialty and general surgery, and bringing that into critical care. Hopefully that will pay off when I do my anesthesia and IC rotations.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, so let's talk about how, again, 240 plus applicants for 4 jobs. Fortunately, I mean, those numbers, you know, they're essentially a little bit exaggerated in the sense that there's a lot of people that apply would have no chance of the job because they're just not in the right. They're not the appropriate applicant for a number of reasons, or they really haven't really thought about it, so their CVs don't look amazing. And there's also a lot of these critical care jobs around Melbourne. So if you're kind of state specific, maybe that 240 number isn't so bad. Maybe it's 150, and maybe the number of jobs isn't just 4, but really those 150 applicants are applying all over Melbourne, and so there may be 20, 30, even up to 40 jobs. So it may be not too bad, but still it is extremely challenging. How do you become successful? I know, you know, personally, because we've had contact for a long time, I've seen your journey throughout. How do you get that job? How do you get successful?
Yeah. What is the secret answer?
It'd be awesome.
There's the, you know, I guess on paper, it's, you know, your application consists of your CV, your cover letter, and your interview. And so, you know,
oh, and I guess, references. Yep.
Oh, and your references, of course. So, you know, you want to do as well in all those components as you can, but then there's also the other things that aren't on your application that aren't, you know, formally assessed on the day, but, you know, still make a huge difference. And that's, I guess, engaging within the department so that the bosses know who you are, and then on the day they'll, you know, be able to recognize you and say, hey, actually, I've seen them around, you know, they're really great. They've done this. And so I guess an example of how I tried to do that with my application was, you know, for example, I didn't have much research. So I wanted to get involved in a research project, you know, either within the department or relevant to the field. So, I got involved in an anaesthetics project in the department. But then, you know, not just doing the research project and the audit, or whatever it is, but going that next step further and, you know, presenting your findings to the department so that they, you know, all the bosses will be able to, you know, see who you are, and then maybe even going that next step further. So then I submitted it for a conference as well. So, you know, from that one thing I did for my, you know, to put on my CV and get a bit more experience, you know, you can then take it a little bit further as well.
How about for all those people that ask that same question and go, hey, various bosses, do you have any projects? And they go, look, we'll call you if we find one. How do you get around that? Was that ever a barrier?
Yeah, and this also happened to me as well. And it's, you know, you feel like you're trying and you're trying and you're just, you know, not getting to where you want to be. But I guess when that happened to me is I looked into other specialties. So, for example, I was trying to get a project in anaesthesia, but then I was going on to intensive care next. So when I was on intensive care, I asked one of the bosses there, got involved in a project in intensive care as well, you know, still quite relevant to anaesthetics. I think at the end of the day, you know, it's just important to get a bit of experience in kind of all those domains on your CV, which we'll touch on later in the podcast as well. So, you know, the perfect project might not come up or...
Okay, there's no projects at all. You get a note from anesthetics, no from ICU. What do you do?
I think, you know, say if there's nothing on the go, then you can still, you know, I guess take the initiative and do things yourself. So, for example, whatever department you're working in, you know, you might have noticed something. Hey, I don't know, we do this in a particular way. Is this meeting, you know, national hospital guidelines? Maybe we could do an audit about it. You know, identifying areas in whatever area you're working that, you know, could be improved and audited. That's another option as well.
That's a good thing you mentioned, is, and also, like, if you look around at any literature or what your mates are doing in other hospitals, if they've done an audit in another hospital and you know, you can get a range of topics that might be done, the chances are that your hospital currently may have not done that. So you could literally just copy the thing that was done in another hospital. And, you know, nothing's original. Everything's old. It's fine. Just do it, get it done. And it's useful for people as well. So, no, that's good. You really have to search sometimes and have initiative. Hey, Paolo, same question to you. How do you get successful?
Yeah. I think I just want to talk about the previous point as well, because I feel like those are two things that I also was trying to work on in my journey, is research as well as maximizing my strengths, which is teaching and leadership. But for research, I think people underestimate the importance of being present and looking at the things that happen on the ward. So for me, what I'm helping drive at our home hospital is the fluid fasting guidelines for our orthogeriatrics patients. And the way that I kind of noticed something that I could improve is that I noticed that these patients who were very high risk of getting acute kidney injuries were fasting for so long and then maybe get cancelled and then have to start another fasting period again the next day. And it was all kind of serendipitous, because at the same time that I was noticing this, I started Googling and realizing that this was actually a huge movement overseas. Mm-hmm. And timing happened that the anesthesia department was also looking at revising their fasting guidelines. So sometimes the opportunity kind of presents itself if you look hard enough in the clinical areas that you're working. But there are also ways to find other ideas, as you've mentioned, Lahiru. The NHS does an incredible amount of auditing within their departments, especially with a standardized system. And there's this book called The Audit Recipe Book, which has every single audit that's been done at the NHS and actually comparing it to a specific standard they try to follow. That's an idea in just a short amount of pages. You can definitely bring that at your home hospital and give you a certain sense of having the idea before it even comes to anyone else. And once you present that to a department that you want to work in, I'm sure someone would jump in, because you've cut a lot of time out of their thinking time to think of an idea for you. Now, all you have to do is drive it and then create results.
Hey, Paolo, that's brilliant. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff isn't sheer brilliance, right? It's not sheer, you know, you don't get some kind of flash from above and go, oh, I've got an idea. We'll put the link to that book, an NHS audit book or whatever that is. And that would, I think, help a lot of people, because really it's about knowing where to look. How did you find out about the NHS, that book?
I was talking about doing audit ideas with a number of people who were more senior than me. And a lot of the barriers that they were talking about is exactly what Ruth was mentioning, which is they would ask for an idea. And unfortunately, with how many people who want to do a project within this critical care space, there's often a shortage of ideas. And then one day I was just Googling and discussing with my friend. And then we thought, hey, what's this on Google? It's something about audits in the NHS. And then up comes this PDF that essentially is this goldmine of ideas, which I've now shared with a lot of my friends, and, you know, helping patient care through audits and research.
Hey, so I just want to touch on another point. Like, this is definitely something I know you guys have done, and it's absolutely something that I had to do during my journey as well. But, you know, things happen not just because there's this specific plan, but because things happen in the peripheries. Like, you know, you talk to someone, you Google something, this is your off time. This is like, if you immerse yourself in this area and just be in that thing, you know, instead of Googling, I don't know, whatever fancy dress you want to buy, or, you know, next, you know, ab equipment. Like, if you're just immersed yourself in the anesthesia world, which it's kind of what you have to do to have these ideas come up from other places. So I really think it takes that kind of dedication. You almost have to be a little bit single-minded in this, you know, maybe for 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 years, where you're really just, you know, observing the landscape of anesthesia. And that's what you're doing. That's your job for that while. Maybe back to the question, Paul. How do you get successful getting a crit kiss? But I think you maybe elaborated on a lot of this already. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think for me, what really helped me stand out, especially as a very junior doc, like trying to get into this space, is that your brand has to be very strong. So for me, I've mentioned it a lot, but I've done a fair amount of leadership work in my previous, before I became a doctor, essentially in medical school and even some before that. But then I also continued that within the hospital space by involving myself in the Junior Doctor Society, the Medical Advisory Council, and some care committees. And showing that brand of yours being developed over time in spaces that change and, you know, certain levels of importance towards patients that change as well, I feel like really shows whoever's reading your CV in a couple of months' time or even in the interview that this is what you're about and you're able to dedicate a certain amount of energy and investment into improving your skills. I feel like as an incoming ANSCA trainee, that's definitely something that would be, something that you guys look for, because it's a space that's quite competitive. It's a space that's very difficult with exam preparation, and someone who's able to show a level of dedication, I'm sure, is someone who would be well suited into this kind of pathway. So I guess from how to be successful, it really takes understanding about what you've done so far, what you feel passionate about, and what you really want to show to people in the future about what kind of medical practitioner and anesthetist you want to be. And that really comes through when you write your cover letter, write your CV, and then do your interview, and they get an understanding of who you are.
Mm, good. Hey, I want to pick up on a point. So every year we get people through for the interviews, and every year there's probably a bunch of cliches, and one of them is brand. And brand is a real thing that's come over the last few years where people, you know, it's a thing, right? Like, you know, definitely in the corporate world, like I think we take a lot of things from other industry. And it's become this thing. And I know that every time someone says brand in our interview, we all giggle a little bit. So I think it's a really great thing to have this, you know, what we used to probably just call this is your, you know, this is who you are, now has a word that's attached to it. That's a very corporate marketing kind of word. I'd almost say once you know what the word is, just never use that word in the interviews. That's for everyone who's kind of listening. Not because it's bad. It doesn't, because then it sounds like everyone's saying it. So it means that everyone's the same on the, you know, the anchor to one word. This happened with the word, I think everyone was passionate. Like passion sounds really intense, and everyone was passionate about stuff. And from an anesthetic consultant point of view, like, how passionate are you? Like this sounds intense. So because there's a generation gap between the people you're interviewing and the interviewers, it's like this real disconnecting. You can say exactly the same things and know that you're talking about something, but, you know, from a very humble opinion of what I know of my little interview panel, we all giggle a little bit at the cliches. But anyway, I absolutely resonate with this brand, because I think, I didn't know it was called brand, but you know, I think when I was progressing through this, I was like, you know what? This is who I am. I'm hardworking and I will get things done. And that's probably my brand. I might move on to choosing the right referee. I think this is really one of the hardest things ever, because you work with someone for, like, you know, at best two times in rotation, like 6 weeks. There's 70 consultants, maybe 80 now in my department. How on earth do you get the right referee? I'll get ahead of you, Ruth. What do you reckon?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, you want to be asking someone, you know, that you've worked with, I guess, as a decent amount, you know, well, that you know, feel comfortable with, and I guess reassured that they're going to have your back, essentially, when you're applying for whatever job you might be applying for. So, you know, applying for a crit care job, I was aiming to have references from crit care departments, although one of my references was an obstetrician, but, you know, because I worked with her a lot, we got on really well, and yeah, I felt like, you know, she's going to give me a good reference, so I'm going to ask her, essentially. But I guess, yeah, you know, you want, when you're asking people for references as well, you want to be asking them at the right time, so not, you know, while they're busy in the middle of a procedure or a time sensitive thing, but, you know, pulling them aside, saying, you know, oh, you know, we've worked a bit together. You know, you've seen me do this. I'm applying for this job, you know, next year. Would you be able to support me in my application by being a reference? And they'll, you know, say, yep, definitely happy to, or, you know, they might say no. And this happened to me as well. When I asked someone when I was early on my PGY2 year, you know, they said, actually, I think it would be better for you to have some more references kind of more, you know, a bit later on, so you've got a bit more time to grow and improve. And, you know, I was really grateful for that because, you know, you don't want someone being your reference if they're not going to, you know, support you 100%. And you know, honesty is really important there as well.
Yeah, having that language of saying, hey, would you be comfortable giving me a strong reference? We all know, like every single consultant knows that you need to have an amazing reference to get to, you know, have a chance of getting this job, right? So I think everyone knows that when you say those words, it's not being pushy. It's like, hey, would you become, you know, hat in hand, hey, you know, I've worked with you a couple of times, really enjoyed it, really learned a lot. Would you feel comfortable giving me a strong reference for this application? If not, that's absolutely fine. And that sounds just really normal and very just empathetic, really. So how about you, Paolo? What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think this is a really tough space, to be honest. It can be quite awkward asking someone to essentially give up their time to do something for you, to help you progress your career. So I found this a pretty challenging space as well. I guess one of the unwritten rules, I guess you could say, is that it's an important skill to be able to read the room. When someone says no, it's not an indication that they want you to work harder for the reference. Sometimes they're just being honest that maybe they may not have the space in order to support you to the best that they can, and that they're asking you that you're probably better looking elsewhere. You should probably take that as Bible and move right along. But I, as with Ruth said, I think it's important to find someone who has seen your ability across multiple aspects of clinical care. So not just your procedural skills, not just how good you can intubate or cannulate someone, but even someone who's seen you speak with patients, do an admission maybe, seen a consult from you. I think someone who's able to see your breadth of skills is a far valuable reference than someone who's only seen you do a specific set of skills and can only comment on that aspect of your ability to care as a doctor. And as well as someone who, you know, will be reliable. I mean, we're people too. We get very busy. There are a lot of conflicting obligations that we have outside of work. So you want to be able to trust your reference to write your reference on time, to complete the forms on time, and get the application done for you. So part of it, really, I would say, is someone who knows you very well, and someone who you know very well, someone who you trust, and then part of that is bridging that conversation, as you said, Lahiru. Can I ask you for a strong reference? I'm really keen on this program. I'm really keen to get into this specialty program. And hopefully when they say yes, that's yes. But if it's no, I would say move along to the next one respectfully.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I think it's really hard. Like in an ideal situation, you get to know people. But, you know, mentioning these things, everything you're saying is really accurate as well. Like, you know, it'd be ideal if you could have someone that sees you through multiple aspects. But, you know, one of these problems is that a lot of your references just won't have. And I think a reference is almost it's almost not a logical decision a lot of the time. Like a lot of medicine is just a lot of life is a good feeling. If you can create a good feeling in your boss, for example, you know, I had a big liver case yesterday. My trainee was there before me. And as soon as I walked in, I was like, you know what? Thank you for being prepared and ready. Like, you know, that my registrar probably could have done a lot of high performance stuff, but already my first impression, my feeling towards her was just great, because I thought, okay, she's working hard for this case, for that you know, opportunity. So, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do to just give a good feeling in spite of not having, you know, so much contact with someone. And then definitely some of the things I've heard other trainees do is say, look, you know, at the end of the day, if you really think you did all right with that consultant, ask for some feedback and say, you know, I try to get feedback from every consultant that I work with. Did you have any constructive feedback for me? I would really appreciate it. And if the feedback is pretty good and you liked working with them and you think they liked working with you, that emotional kind of intelligence that you might have, say, look, you know, would you mind if I tried to roster myself on with you for another time? And you can always ask the admin people. There's always a system in place where people get rostered in, and that's always a possibility. And I think having two contact with, like contact twice with the same person is probably the minimum you need. And so that's totally doable. One of the other things we do at our hospital is we you know, you guys this year will get you to, you know, fill out feedback forms to make sure that we get regular feedback from. So we can even see who's giving you great feedback. And if you're at a loss for a reference, we can say, hey, by the way, Dr. This, give you a pretty good reference, or give you a pretty good end of session review. Maybe you can ask them, and you know, SASA members, we really want you guys to be able to get the right reference as well.
I don't know if this is, sorry, like, here.
There you go.
I don't know if this is important to you, but I think one thing that I really try to do when I'm giving feedback is actually note it down to show that I'm paying attention. Yes. And then the next time I see them again, I said, hey, my goal for this list today is to be able to do this. Do you remember when we had this experience? Is this something you can watch me do this time? Or can you tell me about how I've improved this time? And I feel like that really matters to the consultants and the senior trainees that I work with, because it shows that you're paying attention, you care about what they have to say, and you also care about improving your skill. And even that is enough to, as you said, create a good feeling that this person is switched on, wants to improve, and they're here to do a good job.
Yeah, just to reiterate, if I'm giving a long chute on something and someone's not writing these points down, like, I really think what I'm saying is important. I've got that, you know, confidence, ego, arrogance, whatever it is. And, you know, if they're not writing it down, like, how are you going to remember this? Or is this just me wasting my time? Like, it's like, time is so precious. I really like that what you mentioned there. I think it's a really big deal that you value the time and the knowledge that's been shared with you. So
I'd love to get your opinion just before we move on from references as well.
Yeah,
one thing I found quite tricky, you know, when you're doing shift work, you're working with, like, as you said, lots of different consultants. I did try to ask for references kind of at the start of a day, and then, you know, so then the boss can, you know, really be thinking about it throughout the day, and then by the end of the day, they'll have some things to reflect on for a reference. You know, as a consultant, you'd be giving out references, you know, people would be asking you quite a lot. What do you think when someone, you know, if someone was to ask you at the start of the day versus at the end of the day, do you have a preference, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, actually, I like that idea, because it means that you're priming them for actually reviewing you. Like, they're not going to be distracted necessarily with other things, because you've set that expectation that, hey, look, you know, maybe you've already had an interaction, and now it's that space of, oh, look, this person might be good for a reference, and to prime them, say, look, I'd be looking for a reference, at the right moment, say, hey, I just want to let you know that I really enjoyed working with you. If you thought that you're able to, I'd love to have a consideration for a reference from you. The things that I'll be working on are this, which what we mentioned last time, perhaps on your feedback, to get that kind of conversation going, I think is really useful. Because literally, if someone asks me for a reference and does that, then I can tell them, oh, good, everything I want you to do is already in my videos. If you can do all those things, I'll give you a stellar reference. So it's really easy. Like, nothing, there's no secret to what I expect. It's all out there. Not every consultant obviously has a YouTube channel, but they can definitely give you a rundown of a few things that would be the things that they would expect at the very least, and prime up. So I think that's really useful. Oh, one more thing. When you give that form in, you better make sure it's all filled out, because if I've got to fill out anything more than the bare minimum, that will really annoy me. So no, that's about it. No, that's a good question.
Do you have any thoughts, Lahiru, on sometimes we get really lucky and we actually are offered references, but then there's this feeling inside that you're like, I'm not sure if I was able to show my best self to this particular person reference.
If they're offering you a reference, it would be a real, let's say, it's a real dick move if they give you anything but an outstanding reference. Trust me that if they're offering you a reference, it is going to be at the upper end of references, unless they've got it in for you, which I don't think there's many psychopaths out there who are in that space of wanting to trick you. Oh my God, imagine that was a thing. That would be horrible. No, I really think you should trust that this reference is going to be definitely good. I mean, that said, do you know anyone who's had that experience where they've been offered a reference and then the reference they've got is just a really average one?
Look, I speak with a lot of seniors, and I have heard it a couple of times, unfortunately, really? That when they got the reference back, that it was, you know, it was pretty average.
Are we talking like say the scale is 1 to 5? Imagine if I was saying to someone, I'll give you a reference, that's got to be in the 5s with a couple of 4s. But you're saying that maybe there was 3s or 3s?
Yeah, there was threes, and then some of the comments were not that personal. So I think you can be quite thrown off sometimes when you're offered a reference and then suddenly comes back and it wasn't as stellar as you expected. So I was just wondering if that's something that you have heard from your trainees mentioned before.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of that feels very abrasive to me. I just can't imagine, and obviously you've seen this, but the thought of someone wanting to do extra work to give you average, like that's a loss of, that feels like there's a real disconnect there.
I guess there's really nothing you can do about it, really. Once the reference is done, unfortunately, that's what it is. And with sometimes you can choose whether you want to submit that reference or not. And sometimes you don't find out till the end. So I guess it's just one of those things that you have to really read the room well and know how to respectfully say no when you feel like they haven't seen your best, and then move along.
Yeah. I'm going to say, honestly, if it hasn't happened many times, I'd say if they're offering you references, just gamble on the fact that it's going to be good. I think that's from a probability point of view, that's far more likely. But canvas the room for opinions. You know, my opinion is obviously just one opinion. Let's talk about how to get over this interview. Like, what do you reckon? I love this because I'm asking you a question and I know the inside. So let's see what the inside is now. Paolo, go for it.
You do. Well, first of all, come to the ABCs of anesthesia interview courses. That's always a really good thing. But I think the first thing about doing well in interviews, as someone who teaches interview practice and interview skills, is I think reframing how you think about interviews is important. A lot of people don't want to practice interviews because they fear that they're going to sound robotic. I think it's actually the opposite. You want to be comfortable. You want to show your personality because you're not nervous. And you want to be pointed out for these little cliche things that, Lahiri, you've mentioned earlier. Words like brand, phrases like what I reflected from this is, or my reflection on this situation is, or the summary of what's happened is. Like, things like that can easily be ironed out with a few interview practices with someone who knows how to interview well. And you can only achieve that once you've gotten to, your 7th, 8th, 9th session of practice where you're actually comfortable enough to speak freely and flow effortlessly. So that's always really good. But in terms of the fundamentals, we have so many resources out there available to know the skills on how to interview well in such an important setting. There's a book, I think it's from the UK, which I'm sure we can link as well to this. It's called the ISC Interview Practice Book, and it's geared towards medical interviews, talking about certain ethical scenarios and how to navigate them. But even simple STAR level questions where they're asking you about, tell me about a time you've experienced X, Y, and Z. There's plenty of books out there giving you the fundamentals, but what it really comes down to is enough time to do adequate practice with enough goals in mind, so that someone can watch you achieve those goals over time, someone who knows how to interview well. And for me, in my critical care applications last year, I took about 8 to 10 weeks to get to the level I was comfortable with by the time I was sitting interviews around end of July. So I started around about May-ish. And that's someone who frequently interviews a lot, has done it in a number of spaces. So you really have to know yourself quite well about when you should start practicing and with who as well.
How about you, Ruth? What do you reckon? How did you improve your interview skills?
Yes. So I guess I've gone through the application process twice, and definitely the second time around, I knew that the interview was going to be a big hurdle for me. Just something that doesn't come supernaturally. And so I started practice early. I also found a really good seminar run by one of the medical indemnity insurance companies that was free, that had a medical interview coach running. So there was a couple of sessions there that I attended. And I guess a lot of the interview technique, it's pretty similar across the board, like what Paolo was talking about with the STAR approach and, how to phrase questions and things. But yeah, I guess it's good just to refresh earlier on what kind of approach you should be having to questions. And then I did a lot of brainstorming about different clinical scenarios that I could use as examples. And by the time of the interviews, I had about 5 examples that I knew like back to back and that I could, tailor to different questions. So if I got asked about communication or leadership or when I made a mistake, I could tweak, not lie or exaggerate the example, but just tweak it slightly so I could make those five fit to any question I was going to get asked.
And just to clarify, you're absolutely not, saying any kind of lie. Like, if you're a leadership in one scenario, it's also a time you did well. It's also a time you had teamwork. It's also a time you communicated well. It's also a time you may have got some criticism. Like, these scenarios are rich with experiences. So having good scenarios and writing them down as they happen so that you're ready for them, it's almost like any kind of performance. Like, I know stand-up comics, they will write things down that have happened in their life and they've got a whole database to look back on. This is kind of like interview. It's a bit of a performance as well. Sorry, I cut you off, Ruth.
And then just practicing, lots and lots of practice, lots of different people, other people applying for the same job, colleagues that aren't applying for the job, senior colleagues, medical, non-medical people, family, friends. Like, I think there are about three people that I practice with quite consistently, and then lots of different people kind of scattered throughout as well. Online practice and in-person practice. Now a lot of the interviews are transitioning back to in-person. Like Powell and I, we did an in-person practice over brunch one day, which was quite nice. So just trying to do lots of practice as well.
But how different was it, Ruth, doing it in person compared to us doing it completely online? How did that feel different for you?
So different. You picked up on so many things that I was doing that I did not realize I was doing, like with my hands and my general body language. I think you said I was like quite twitchy. Maybe I'm just twitchy at baseline, but like just trying to kind of fine tune those things before the interview. I think maybe this year we're applying for training. I think I'll probably do a bit more in-person practice rather than Zoom this year, I think.
This is such a interesting thing, because I really do think it's a performance. Like, I actually don't think the interview means anything really personally. I think a lot of people think it does. There's no evidence that interviews do anything, but it's part of the selection process. And just to give people some insight, the application process and the selection process for all of these positions in medicine are extremely subjective, and even if they are objective, they're allowed to be differently objective with different criteria depending on the person. And that's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just how it is, and there's strength, advantages and disadvantages of this. It means that, when you come for your interview, hopefully, you get pre-select, you get selected for the interview, which is an amazingly massive, like, it's a really, really big thing. And then some people will mark you on all your other facets, not just your CV and your references, but the interview, and maybe just the fit that they feel for the department. There's the fit factor, which are, again, these are arbitrary marks that people are applying, and also they're variable, across the board. And some people will only score the interview. Then just pause for that for a second. If they're only scoring your interview after you get to the point, that is an that puts so much pressure on this interview, which, again, I don't think is an evidence-based thing. Neither is the whole application process, but we need a process anyway. So it means that, if you can't do this game and this performance of the interview, you've got no chance, because there's, some panel members who are only scoring the interview. I think it's a really unfortunate system, but there's no real better system. There's a lot of things in life that are unfair and have a competitive thing. And, whether you're lucky in one circumstance, you may be unlucky in another, but all you can do with this is do extreme practice, especially if you know you're not great at interviews. Find a performance psychologist, find an interview coach, find every single friend who's willing to sit down with you. And just like you guys, you don't have to make it formal. Like, I know for my primary exam as well, like, I didn't just sit down, I immersed myself. I was, on the way to coffee, we were firing questions at each other. You can do that with this, say, hey, how are you going to approach this question? How would you say this? The fact that you've thought about it, and you're constantly talking about it, is this concept of immersion that makes, which means that you are constantly thinking about this and able to provide answers for random things that might come up. And I think that's a really, really, really good skill. And I want to touch on authenticity as well, because, there's going to be stuff that, there's things about you that are genuinely not optimal, but they're real. And when we hear something that's just truly authentic, and it's hard to put a real weakness out there. But if you really have something, I, I, I you know, this one trainee was so prepared. It was ridiculous. Every answer was verbatim, you know, it was scripted. And I was impressed by that. I was like, I've never met someone that scripted this answer. And if I'd said, yeah, what's your weakness? And he said, look, as you can see, I've practiced a lot for this and I've memorized these answers because I think that this is so important for me. It was obvious to me. I already knew that, but this person had insight and knowledge and read the room well. And the fact that they were, you know, revealing that as a weakness and they knew it, that they've got to learn how to, you know, I think it's quite impressive. If I saw more authenticity, which again, I don't know if I would be able to do in this context because it's so high stakes. I'm saying that if you can be authentic and hopefully not too vulnerable at this point, I think it's a really strong thing.
Yeah, I feel like that does come with practice though, Lahira, and having the mindset that you're practicing for comfort to show your true self rather than practicing to memorize robotic answers. Mm. I feel like the only time you can really be that authentic is when you're comfortable. If you're rigid, nervous, thinking too hard about the question, it's very hard to come across authentic. And part of it really is giving the interviewers the right feeling that you're the right fit, you know, the right feeling in the interview. I feel like that's only achieved with long practice with the right people.
Absolutely. Hey, so we've got a few minutes left, but I was hoping we did have this CV cover letter section that, and you've got some really good points listed out, Ruth. Maybe should we go to you and you can just list those to get through? Is that okay, Paolo, in terms of time?
Yeah.
Beautiful. Hey, yep. Ruth, so CV, cover letter, what makes it good? You've got some great notes there.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess your CV, there's, you know, everyone's CV will be a slightly bit different, but there's kind of main points that you need to hit. So I'll just go, run through those points. So I guess first it usually starts with education. So, you know, undergrad, postgrad degrees, you know, if you've done a non-medical job as well, that's, you know, you say you've worked in, like Paolo, you've worked in banking for a few years. So, you know, that you can draw on those strengths as well for your medical application. So, yeah, if it's relevant, definitely include that. And same goes with employment. So mainly you want to hit, you know, all the rotations you've done from PGY1 to where you are now. But again, if you've been employed in a non-medical job for X amount of time, that can also be useful to include there as well. And then, so the next point would be achievements and awards. So, you know, anything that stands out from medical school, if you've won any prizes or scholarships in research or what, and any awards, you know, within your health service as well, you might have received. And then you might include, so professional development would be the next one. So, you know, courses you've done, whether that's, you know, your advanced life support or any online courses, or, you know, things relevant to the specialty that you're, you know, looking to pursue. And then through research, so any projects you've been involved in, you know, audits, you know, if you've been lucky to be involved in a big multi-center, you know, randomized controlled trial, you know, throw that in as well. And, you know, like I was saying before, I guess one thing I tried to do with my research was, you know, I was involved in a small number of projects, but then trying to, you know, stretch out the opportunities for each project. So, you know, doing the audit, but then also presenting it and then submitting it for a conference as well. So including all those things. Leadership, Paolo touched quite a bit on leadership, some of the committees he's been involved in. So, you know, both medical school, in the workforce as well, you know, most hospitals will have a junior doctor society or, you know, a safer care committee, you know, things that you can, you know, easily get involved in as well if that's something that you want to improve on. And then there's also, you know, special interest groups outside of the hospitals as well. So, for example, Doctors for an Environment or, you know, Victoria has a Women in Medicine committee as well. So there's so many opportunities out there. And I guess an important thing with leadership is not just saying, oh, you know, I was on this committee, this was my role, but, you know, what difference did you actually make in that position? So, you know, I was the, you know, surgical rep on my on the Junior Doctor Society, and we were able to implement these changes for the residents and junior doctors there. And then, yeah, so any teaching or, volunteering positions you've been in. So, Lahira, you run ABCs of Anesthesia, the brains behind the operation, and, you know, that's a great platform. Anyone who is interested in anesthetics and wants to get involved in teaching, definitely hit us up, lectures, podcasts, so many things you can do. But then, also teaching within your hospital as well. So, contacting the uni that has medical students at your hospital, and maybe you could get involved in shoots there at the bedside or lectures for the medical school. Lots and lots of things for teaching as well. And then at the end of the CV, most people will put in some personal interests that they have. These are the things that you like to do in your spare time. What makes you unique? How are you going to stand out amongst the other applicants as well? So, but overall, you want to put the most important things on your CV. I think, 3 to 4 pages is pretty standard now. If you're going beyond that, then I guess you're going to, risk losing meaning in what you're putting on your CV. Things relevant to the job you're applying. That's about CV. Did you want to talk a bit about the cover letter as well?
I'll just mention the CV. So again, I think this is all good. I've covered a lot of this on the foundations course, but also the earlier podcast on the application process. So feel free to have a look at that. We kind of deep dive into a few of these things. Look, one of the things that's happened recently is that people definitely stretch the truth on the CV, and just whatever you do, just don't do it. This is a real public service announcement. Like, the anesthetic world is extremely small. If you haven't done a rotation, there's just all these red flags that happen, and we can tell a lot of these things. If some research is in progress and you haven't defined exactly what part of that progress it's up to, like, I've had people who haven't done much at all and they've put that as in progress, and I know that that's not accurate. These are things that it's a small world. We know what's going on. Just whatever you do, that's a career ending move. Like, not career ending, but you can potentially not get the job because now I can't trust you, or the system doesn't trust you anymore. So whatever you do, please don't shoot yourself in the foot by saying anything that's not exactly true. If you, everyone that gets shortlisted for our interviews, has to provide evidence for every single award that they've got or course that they've attended. So please have those ready, because, we've got no time for anything that's not accurate, because it's too high stakes. And, we're not going to give the job to someone who hasn't been completely honest on their CV. So just a PSA, I feel like there's something that's happened recently. I hadn't seen it. I've only been doing this process for the last 3 or 4 years. So I'm not sure what was happening before, but I suspect it's pretty rare. But please, I know that good people will do things desperately and, in desperate times, like trying to get a job that's really competitive. So just please don't. Good. PSA done. Cover letter.
Yeah. Did you want to talk about the cover letter, Paolo?
Cover letter, I think should be maximum 1 page. I think the cover letter is interesting in that there's only so much to say about you and why you're fit for anesthesia. But the real things to take away from the cover letter is that it has to exactly affirm what you've written on your CV in compact form that is readable for the audience. There's a lot of things about cover letter that we can go into, and Lahira, you've spoken a lot about it in your deep dive to applications. But one thing that people underestimate when it comes to cover letter writing is the power of AI. I think that AI these days can really do well in providing you ideas, but at the end of the day, what you need to take from that is to turn it into your own authentic voice. But I think starting off with AI about what you actually want to say in your cover letter, letting whatever platform write it for you, and then changing it to your voice and making it sound like you, really goes a long way in speeding up and doing a good cover letter for the process.
That's a really good point. So definitely use AI. It's out there. It is absolutely a vital tool. Sometimes it's just to get you over that first hump of writing it, right? So I remember I was in a meeting, I needed to draft a letter, got AI to do the letter. By the end of it, it was my letter. I had changed everything, but it gave me the start, gave me a couple of words, gave me a sentence structure. It was incredibly useful for brain block. But if you have something just completely written by AI, everyone knows when it's written by AI now. It's so obvious because it's too perfect. You can't have something that perfect. Absolutely. And the cover letter, often it really is just, that sounds pretty standard. It's hard to stand out a cover letter. don't get the name of the hospital you're applying for wrong. That's incredibly bad form. Because, you know, with the way we think of it, yeah, in medicine, it is a, you've got to be thorough in this. If you're not checking over what you're writing, it's a critical error. You should absolutely always highlight things in bold, underline, you know, the big items in your CV. That's really useful. And if you've changed career, if there's a reason why you're a PGY8, if there's a reason why you were an obstetrics person and now you're thinking of anesthesia, or you're moving from New South Wales or some other state, these are the things that we need to know. And that the CV doesn't tell us that. It's a cover letter that gives you opportunity to explain yourself. Otherwise, we just go, oh, you're not really wanting to move to Melbourne. Like, you're just applying for, you know, we don't have an insight into your reasons. So I think that's absolutely where you've got to be authentic and honest about that. Hey guys, so this has been a great show. We've gone for about an hour. Do you guys have any final thoughts or anything to add?
Oh, I think one of the most helpful things I found was just speaking to people, you know, who've gone through the process recently, people who are also applying with you as well, you know, being able to then bounce ideas off each other, you know, how did you do your CV and can we practice interviews, and just getting advice from people as well. I think, you know, that was probably the thing that made the big difference the second round I applied. The first time round, you know, I just moved to the health service in the state and didn't know many people. So, yeah, the second time round, having that support from, you know, colleagues and seniors as well, yeah, made a huge difference.
Yeah, I have to echo that, Ruth. I think having other people who've been through the journey and giving you the blueprint on how to succeed, I think is completely invaluable. And then meeting people who are also very interested in the same journey as you has been quite a really empowering process to have that kind of support. But I think the important thing is that you just have to enjoy it. It can get very stressful. It's a high stakes environment with a lot of pressure. But at the end of the day, like, this is just the start of a very long journey in your career. If you don't enjoy it now, when are you going to enjoy it? So that's it.
Yeah. As hard as it is, imagine enjoying interviews. Like, I'd say I enjoy interviews now. Like, now it's like, I don't care if I get a job or not. Like, I went to an interview a year ago and it felt enjoyable. Like, it almost feels like, oh, you want me now. Like, I'm actually just, this is a formality. You've asked me to interview, you want me, and I'm just going to sit back and enjoy the process. So anyway.
I aspire to get to that level, the hero.
Yeah, that's right.
One day.
It's all a journey. Anyway, guys, really thank you for offering this as an idea for a podcast. That was really enjoyable. Thank you for, you know, outlining it for me as well, so that we could go through the things you wanted to talk about. I think that absolutely what we needed to hear. And just remember, so you guys came to me with this podcast idea because you thought, yeah, this is what's relevant at this point for now. The fact that, you know, you're coming up with these authentic ideas from your point of view, because a lot of the time, you know, people will offer, you know, they don't want to offer to do educational articles or whatever it is, or content, because they're like, well, I'm not a specialist, I don't have the expertise. But just remember, there's a world out there of people who are just at your level or just below your level. And what you've got to add is so much more valuable, or equally as valuable as what a specialist 10, 20 years ahead of you has, because it's just closer to what is relevant. So yeah, thanks so much for initiating this. It's been really great. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your weekend and enjoy the sun.
Awesome.
Thanks, Siri.
See you guys. And I'll just, thanks, everyone. This is ABC's Anesthesia on the podcast and on YouTube. Please share with anyone who might like to listen to this kind of stuff. And we'll see you all again next time. Thanks a lot.